Good evening, and welcome to yet another episode of The Last Knock. Or is it The Last Knock before The Last Knock was The Last Knock?
Dude, you're messing with my head already. Holy shit.
We are well into the stim I'm just going to say the stimulation, the simulation here, Bill. I am Johnny Numb. Joining me tonight, as always, is
Billy Crash.
in the Matrix.
I wish, man,
I
that
was
would
gonna,
be.
at this point, yeah.
I know Kung Fu, you know. Right now, I don't know anything, you know, and I could probably have hair. Go ahead.
Tonight we are going to be talking about horror origins, and what forms horror origins take. We're not talking about the origins of the genre, more so just stories, characters sort of go back to the beginning with a character or a certain story, and our thoughts on whether the idea of an origin story is a good thing. Oftentimes, especially these days, we see a lot of iconic horror characters from iconic franchises being prequelized in kind of an attempt to,
Boo.
yeah, not maybe may, maybe the intention is not to demystify the devil. I think the intention is more
Getting
maybe just as
money.
yeah, maybe just as cynical though. But there are other cases where sometimes, I think anyway, I've found some examples of where learning about a character's origins or the origins of an occurrence or a certain story is actually beneficial to the film itself. So yeah, I think we're just gonna kind of have a general discussion on whether an origin story, you know, is a friend or foe, and bring up examples of when it's done well and when it's
Well,
done not so well. So, do you have anything to add to that, Billy, or any trends or patterns you noticed when you're kind of thinking about movies to bring up?
One of the things that bothers me about origin stories is, well, first of all, if it's from a comic book character, you know, the first movie is always the origin thing. And all of these fans are sitting in the stands waiting for like a cool story, but oh no, you got to go through this for the people who don't know. And it's like, oh, you know, unless they do it right, like Batman Begins, you know, I thought that was really well done.
Oh,
Ant-Man, that was a lot of fun, you know, stuff like that. And, normally, it, like you said, you know, the demystification of a character, especially if it's a horror movie, you want that element of mystery, you want suspense, you want. So I don't want to know how the sociopath, the psychopath was born, how they were made, or any crap like that. I don't. This is why I love the Joker movie for the cinematography and the acting. The story to me was not right at all for Joker. And it's like, and they were demystifying the Joker for me, and I didn't want. He's just insane. Where did he come from? Who knows? That's part of the fear. That's part of that magical element that keeps us grounded in wanting to see what he does next. And I guess movie-wise, and this is my fear, is there was a slasher film that came out a little while ago. In 2016, called Terrifier, as you know. Starring the great David Howard Thornton as Art the Clown. We had him on the show. He was fantastic and great guy. Just love him. And, you know, it's directed and written by Damien Leone. And now, apparently, the second movie is going to be that prequel, is going to get tells the origin. And I'm like, I don't want to know. I don't want to know. This crazy, messed up, silent clown comes from nowhere. He terrifies people. He's just, you know, we know there's something supernatural about him, but I don't want to know. I don't need to know. He's like the MacGuffin in a classic Hitchcock story, which is, it's not what they're going after, like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. We don't know what's in it. They know what's in it. It doesn't matter what's in it. What matters is everybody wants it.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same with Get Out. Well, what were they doing with the surgery? What was that? How did they get the black person's soul?
Who cares?
Like, that's
Who cares?
Not the point, you dipshit. The point is, you fucking idiot. The point is, what's going on? How's it affecting people, characters, all of that? That's the important element. So when I heard we're getting backstory for the second Terrifier movie, I was like, no. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Well, that's interesting, Bill, because I was thinking that was just a straight sequel, or is it going to be like a sequel with backstory elements to it?
I'll check right now. Why not? Since we're okay. Here, because clickety click.
But to what you said, Bill, it's like something I love about Art the Clown is that, granted, I haven't seen the short film from All Hallows Eve that he was in, pre-Terrifier. Mm-hmm. But Terrifier was just like, it's just that random bit of chaos represented by that character that just totally throws these people's lives into a tailspin over one night.
Right.
And that, to what you said, that's frightening enough, knowing he can pop out just anywhere at any time and mm-hmm. String you up and tie you in, you know, and saw you in half like a like basically a cow in a slaughterhouse. So, yeah. You know, it's stuff like that element of the random and the unexpected, and kind of, I think something you were getting at is like when there's something enigmatic about a character or a plot device, like the MacGuffin, like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that stuff stands on its own if the writing and the characters surrounding it, as we keep going back to, you know, is good. You know, if that stuff is strong, you're not going to need a weak writer would explain that stuff away.
Yeah.
You know, a good writer finds a way to make that, to integrate that into the story, or character, and sort of trust it to carry itself
mm-hmm.
because the other elements are so strong anyway.
Yeah, well, that's why I liked Hellraiser too. I enjoyed Hellraiser. There's parts of it that are a little hard to even look at. it's messed up. I thought it was fantastic. I enjoyed it. Hellraiser 2 came out. I loved that too. And the only origin piece we get is Pinhead. And it's pretty brief. And it was just like any other character who's like, I want the box. No, you don't. But they get it anyway. Because human beings are naturally stupid. And he opens the thing and he's eventually turned into Pinhead. The great sadomasochistic Cenobite, which in later films was ludicrous because they said they're demons now, but they're not. They're demons to some, angels to others. It's like, why did you do that crap? I don't know. But that wasn't bad. You know, that was great because I really enjoyed Hellraiser 2. It's one of the few sequels that I was like, wow, this is great. But, you know, they didn't go into like, if they did in the later episode, they went into how the box came about. And that actually was fun though. I didn't think that was a perfect film by any means. That's not in my top like 500 best horror films or anything like that. But, you know, it was fun because they went back in time. Then they, of course, like Jason in space, they did Hellraiser in space and they did all this crazy shit. And after a while you're like, oh, whatever. And,
right.
But, keeping like the beauty of like Hellraiser is the mystery of the puzzle box. Where did it come from? We don't know. And that just only amps up the fear. Once we know its origin, the fear elements are gone, everything else. I don't want to see a movie where Freddy Krueger is the actual janitor and we get to follow him and see what he's going through day by day. I don't want to know that. We still don't know if he sexually abused these kids before he killed them. We don't know, but that's always been a point of, you know, conjecture.
Mm-hmm.
And that added to his mystique, because at one point you're like, oh my God, that line was hilarious because he's a one-liner guy. And yeah. Brian Englund, you know, he makes this character come alive. Robert Englund. Did I say Brian? Yeah. That's his brother. I don't even know. But anyway, I was, you know, it was just, so it's like, at one point you're like sort of liking this guy, and in slasher films you like to see, hey, how is this character going to get killed? But you're rooting for these characters, and you're also, I know a lot of people have it in the back of their mind, but you know, he killed children, and he may have sexually abused them first. How could I laugh at what this guy's saying? And that added to, I think, the whole like sub-traumatic elements of A Nightmare on Elm Street films, you know?
Yeah, you know, something interesting about like that, you know, you brought up the sort of the conjecture about whether he molested the kids or just killed them. It's another interesting ambiguous point, at least in the first film. And I'll admit a very shameful thing. I've only really seen the first film, New Nightmare, and the remake, so I really gotta gotta fill in those gaps. Yeah, I'm awful. Sorry, horror fans.
Don't apologize for that. Just like a million horror movies, 999,000 of them are awful. But and you and I've seen our share of horrible ones, but. The original with Johnny Depp's character in it, I mean, that scared me when I saw it, because they did some amazing practical effects in there that were like mind-blowing to me.
And, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and it was just I want to revisit that. And since there's shit on Amazon Prime and Netflix streaming right now, it's like, well, why not? You know, at least Shudder tries to bring positive content. You know, it's like, hey, you haven't seen this before. Maybe we have, maybe we haven't, but thanks for giving us something. Right. Different than the usual crap we get shoved down our throats. Yeah, thank you, Shudder.
Yeah, that's valid. Yeah, I guess what I was going to say, Bill, was the thing that at least isn't explained in the first film is just what exactly about the grown-ups burning Freddy to death. What about that allows him to actually enter the kids' dreams? There's no explanation as to how he can do what he can do.
Nope.
And at the same time, I'm like, I don't care that I don't know
exactly
why he can do what he can do. He just does it. And it's a strong enough and unique enough premise that, you know, granted, I'll sit back and ask it for the purposes of the show, but at the same time, it doesn't really bother me. It's not a question that nags at me thinking, oh, well, if I were Wes Craven, I would have figured out a way to explain that away. It's like, no, it's not that at all. So I'm like, that's another example of just like, just a detail of plot or whatever that you don't need it.
Yeah, exactly. Like I hate any movie, and they exist. There's tons of them, and I can't think of many titles right now. But you know, somebody like walks into a town, nobody's there. They can't find anybody, and they're like, "How did I wake up? What's going on?" And the whole thing is amping this mystery. And I'm always thinking in my head, "How's the writer gonna fuck this up?" Because that's exactly what they're gonna do, and they do it every time. And it's like, oh, and it just pisses me off. Like, don't blink. It's like they had something good. They did a couple of stupid things in it that I would edit out, but that made no sense. But it was, they did a really cool job up until maybe the finale. And I like the movie to such a degree, it's almost like an excuse a couple of things. But like, I don't know. I mean, I would hate to have an idea. And I've had ideas for stories like that, but I don't know how they're going to end. And I don't want to ruin them, so I don't write them. You know what I mean? It's like, what's the point, you know?
I think it's easy to fall into kind of a trap of maybe doubting your own what you're creating to the point where, and I guess this is what you have to separate yourself from as an artist, is like that get away from what you think the audience is going to think and just kind of trust your instincts. Because I know I've tried to write stuff with certain parameters in mind, and I've always kind of wound up disappointed with it because I'm like, I'm doing this for the wrong reason. I just should be listening to my gut because there is something to that, I think. And when you start thinking, well, how's the viewer or how's the reader going to react to this? You kind of jinx yourself, I think.
Agreed.
So, And I mean, there is a place for stuff to be explained away and explained well, I think. And you can still have a good movie or a good book. I mean, but I think just, and this is like my personal taste is more, as I get older, I'm more interested in the stuff that's really well set up and really well built. And I like to walk away with having questions. I like to think about it. I don't like to be like, okay, here's everything you wanted to know, and it's over with. And I'm like, I'm usually more disappointed in that than if a filmmaker can build mood or atmosphere, and I walk away kind of like thinking about the atmosphere, thinking about the mood. What did a certain gesture mean on the character's part? That's why I like The Killing of a Sacred Deer so much, for example, just like that, the way Lanthimos crafted that film was just like, so like, what the hell is going on and what's it all about? What's it all mean? And I just love that at the end, you're still kind of asking those questions. So.
Yeah. And I did like that movie to some degree, and other ways I didn't. And it was, I think, more about pacing than anything else. And, you know, sometimes I'm in a mood for that, because I know some people are like, oh man, The Ninth Gate is boring. Man, I could watch that movie 20 times in a row. You know what I mean? And I don't think it's boring at all. But that was like, you know, and we're not really getting away from it. This is another one, The Dead Don't Die, you know, Jim Jarmusch film. Sure. It started out good, and it was interesting. And then he has, at the end of the movie, Tom Waits explain everything that you just saw that was clear to figure out unless you were a complete idiot and had no clue what was going on. And I'm like, why did you just insult the audience? Why did you do that? Why did you, you know? And that's another thing with like an origin story. It's like, if you're revealing the obvious, then there's nothing to reveal.
Right. Right.
So that's it. I'm done.
All right. Sounds good. That's our show. Thank you everybody for tuning in. Be sure to tip your waitress.
Damn straight. Try to land.
Well, you know, Bill, to what you were saying about The Dead Don't Die, you know, and bringing it back to origin stories, you know, I get more pissed off when something is advertised as an origin story and there's no effort at all, really, to, it's more a title than anything. You know, if you're going to at least try to exploit this character and demystify the devil, why not do as much as you possibly can with it? So at least maybe you're going down in a hail of with your fists flying, even though you might have a totally wrongheaded idea about things. One of the films I hate the most out of all of the movies I've seen, so much I wanted to walk out when I saw it in the theater, is the prequel to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh man.
You know, even R. Lee Ermey could not, he was actually one of the problems with that movie. it was just like this very dismal, ugly thing. But aside from all of that, really the only thing that has to do with an origin story, there's some really infinitesimal crap in that movie that has to deal with the origins of Leatherface and some of the other characters, but it's just so threadbare and just so simple and basic, and there's just nothing really to it. And through the opening credits, they're like showing images of Leatherface as a little child and everything like that. And then after that, they jump ahead to him being like, where, you know, like 20, 30 years old. So it's kind of a pointless thing. And, you know, the sad thing is, the guys who made Inside went back to the well and they did Leatherface, which was supposed to be another origin story. And that thing was a piece of shit too.
Yep.
So it's like, geez, it was just a very conventional, they were trying really to make the Devil's Rejects out of a Texas Chainsaw Massacre story, which seems kind of redundant. So it's like, you know, you had some good ideas at the start and then it just like totally went nowhere. It was just a totally empty, meaningless exercise. And that's like, yeah, those are like two really bad examples, I think, of
I have a third.
oh, okay, well, by all means, since we're on that path,
Yeah,
yeah.
The Thing 2011.
Now I want to ask you because
Jump in, Johnny.
because I do have a certain affection for that film. What is your I can understand it's not a perfect movie, but
No.
what are your thoughts on that? What did it do that it didn't? What did it not? What did we not need? Or why did we not need that movie?
We didn't need 90 minutes of their bullshit. No, we didn't. No, and there's certain elements of the movie I did like, but it's the whole metal element. If somebody has metal in them, it doesn't. The thing can't duplicate that. Like if somebody has a filling or some shit, and it's like, come on. And like I always wondered about the spaceship. That was a giant spaceship. There's one thing in it. Did it hold multiple things and they all came together? Did he absorb it, he, she, or it, whatever it is? Did they absorb the crew and it's somebody else's design? And like how? And is this the only thing in the universe because it's so self-contained and compartmentalized, even though it could branch out? Are they taking over planets all over the universe? It's like just this insane shit, it's like so cool. And I just thought that the remake and showing that that one Norwegian guy was clumsy, that's why, to try and match up. And I like some of the things they did to try and match up with the John Carpenter version of it, was cool, but it was like, come on, man, just don't give me a prequel. The alien, the Prometheus, fuck you.
Oh, that's well, we'll both agree that that one was terrible.
It was disgusting. And it was like the beautiful thing is, when a new species is discovered, it's like, well, we don't know where it came from. And, and it takes time and all of this stuff, and it's cool. I don't need to know, where it came from, this magical, mystical bullshit that they did in Prometheus, which is absolutely hideous. It's so awful. It's just, and I'm like, people go, oh, well, it's part of the franchise. Like, not in my book. And then again, I hate aliens, so it's like, I just like, just give me the original movie and just take all your other alien related crap and just shove it,
Yeah, personally, Bill, I'm kind of with at this juncture, I'm kind of with you. I think to quote Ash from the original Alien, that movie is like a perfect, almost a perfect movie for me.
Same here, man.
It doesn't really even, I can see how James Cameron and the writers sequelized it, and I can see why so many people like that sequel. But
I can't.
I think the thing with the 79 film is it just stands by itself so well. And it really, I mean, people can love that series and they can, or you can just love that movie and it works totally by itself or as a lead into what was to come. But I don't think what came after it was anywhere near as good.
No, and my favorite part of Alien, my favorite part of the mystery was the company, because it didn't have a name then, which was brilliant. The company sent Ash, the robot, to protect this thing. So they knew it was there. How did they know it was there? Were other people infected? Was another crew destroyed? It's like, oh, that's so cool. And it like, I don't want to know. I don't want to know. It's like they don't know. The characters don't know. The audience doesn't know. That means you're one of the crew on the Nostromo. And you're like, the whole thing's a mystery to me, man. And it's great. Because once you know something that the other characters don't know, you're waiting for them to catch up. And that's bad writing. That's I, Stranger Things, piece of shit because of that stupid series. It's absolutely hideous. It's a Flintstone plot where Wilma knows something, Fred knows the other half, but they don't talk to each other. And the whole show, you're ripping your hair out. That's why I went bald, because of freaking Flintstones. Like, would you just talk to each other? And I hate that. Stranger Things, you have like people with all these different pieces, no one's saying a word. And it's like, screw it. And then they save the world, and then they have a second season. How are you going to top that? You just saved the world. It's like, I don't get it. But, you know, it's just ridiculous. And you get parts of that on The Walking Dead, which I don't – which is, you know, a soap opera with zombies. It's like – it's just – I don't get it. It's just – I don't know why people are, like, okay with that stuff when it's – the writing isn't there.
I mean, I can understand.
I'm like, winded.
No, it's okay, Bill. I'll talk for a little bit.
Thank God. I need a drink. Vodka preferred. Go ahead, bud.
You know, I think when I was younger, and I was like an ignorant little kid, you know, it's like I would watch anything that was plopped down in front of me that seemed even remotely cool. But now that I'm older, it's like I find that to be one of the most intelligence insulting things is when filmmakers and showrunners operate on that template, you know. Mm-hmm. Why would you want why would you want the viewer to be ahead of the characters? That's just like, oh my God, it's like you said, it's agonizing to watch that.
Yep.
You know, in just a 90-minute movie, let alone a TV show that's running for like a 12-episode season. My God, I don't know how people do it. But it is lazy. And, you know, I think, again, we're going back to sort of maybe not a crux of the prequel argument, but maybe part of it is just kind of like there is a laziness to it. You've said it before, Bill, like even before the pandemic, Hollywood was like a closed shop for original screenplays. Mm-hmm. They want superheroes. They want known entities that they can recycle and make more money off of.
Yeah, because if there's an established fan base, they want it. They don't care what it is.
Yeah, just to pretty much grind it down until there's nothing left to grind, basically.
Yeah. You sold 5 million books. That means we'll probably start out with 5 million people in the seats. Let's do it. Let's make this movie.
Exactly.
Awful.
Yes, and I think that's why we have sort of these films that venture into prequel territory, origin story territory, is because that's the last idea we have, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it's one of the last ideas we have. So let's give Leatherface a shitty backstory. You know, let's give even though it was based off of a book, let's give Hannibal Lecter some youthful angst to explain why he became the monster he is.
And and they never study psychology. It's like, he's a sociopath. Talk to a therapist. Read a fucking book on your subject, you morons. It pisses me off. And they conjure up this crap that's nonsensical. And, oh, man. Like, that was the horrible part about Psycho. I would say I would have Psycho by Hitchcock, 1960. That would be one of my greatest horror movies ever made if he cut the last 15 minutes of that film. Where he has
the explanation.
Yeah, the whole exposition thing about, oh, this is the way he is. No, just show us him smiling at the end. Creepy. Roll credits, man. We don't need to know. Mm-hmm. And he just blew it with that. It pisses me off. That's why Peeping Tom is so fantastic, which came out the same year from the UK. Yep. It's intense. It's insane. It's more powerful than Psycho in so many ways. It's unsettling. And that's it.
Yeah, and you know, Bill, that's kind of interesting because Peeping Tom has elements of the main characters, like psychology, like sort of where it could have possibly stemmed from without reverting to dialogue. You know, it's mm-hmm. just he's showing the woman who lives downstairs some films his father, who was like a doctor, shot of him when he was a little kid. And I don't think there's any sound on these movies.
Right.
But there's this really disturbing moment where the father tosses a lizard on the kid's bed and to capture the fear reaction of the kid waking up to see this in his bed. So, and that ties into all this stuff about voyeurism and why this character is obsessed with fear. And it's just, I think, a few minutes long, if that, of a little bit of a backstory with this character. So in that case, if you want to look at that, that is giving you some origin detail without giving away the ghost, as it were, I think.
Yeah, and you're still like, that's all we know. What else do we not know? And you know, and it's like, that's one little element, not this grandiose explanation that's just hideous.
Yeah, you're still wondering why that character got to, why he seems so well put together, yet he's on the inside, he's so disturbed. That's a lot of that mm-hmm. is left to conjecture. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that the end of Psycho undermined Anthony Perkins' phenomenal performance in that. He was brilliant, creepy as hell. And it's like, I just wanted to leave, like, ugh, with that shiver, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Hitchcock took it away, you know, I think. And it's funny because he did almost the exact opposite in the movie Rebecca, which isn't a horror, but it has horror elements to it, has mm-hmm. ghostly, haunting elements to it that are psychological, where almost like the camera's following nothing, but you can imagine the living, breathing Rebecca, whatever she really looked like, walking through these rooms, and we sense her presence, and it's disturbing. And I'm not even going to watch the remake. I heard it's absolute trash. You know, I'm not going to watch it because I know they have somebody playing actually Rebecca in it. And it's like, why? Why? The whole point is she's not there. And yeah, once you take the mystery out, and it just, you're killing that whole element that you wanted people to come into the seat in the theater to experience to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
That's why I like The Ninth Gate. The Ninth Gate is 1,000 times better than the book. I don't know how they got the story that they did out of it. And at the end, it's like you're wondering, well, what now? And that's what you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's what I want every time. The Vatican Tapes. I know a lot of people didn't like that movie. Some haven't seen it, whatever. The ending, I think, is fantastic because it's like, now what? You know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to know what. I don't want another. I don't want a sequel. I just like what you just set up is like, this is awesome. And roll credits. I'm out on the awesome. That's great. You know?
Yeah, no, I agree with that, Bill. I was thinking about, you know, oftentimes there are a lot of movies, and the obvious path you could go down with an origin is to have a kid as the central character who stands the chance of growing into something awful, like the good, like, you know, Macaulay Culkin and The Good Son. I was thinking more, actually, just as an example, I think the movie Alice, Sweet Alice kind of serves as a really good origin story, because you start off with this sibling rivalry between Brooke Shields, who's the sister to Alice, played by Paula Shepherd, and the Paula Shepherd character is just very, she's very mischievous. She likes to cause trouble. She likes to wear a mask. She likes to tease the really sleazy ass landlord in their building.
Right. Almost like the bad seed in many ways.
Yeah, actually. And there's so much that comes out about her character as the film progresses. And you're always like sort of, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, okay, is she responsible for all of the string of murders that starts to happen? How would she be capable of it? You know, but you start asking these things, and then the film reaches a point, at the end, and I'm not going to give it away,
mm-hmm.
where you feel like, oh, this could just be the beginning of something for this character. You know, granted, there was never an Alice, Sweet Alice Part two,
thankfully,
but you know, I think that's interesting, where that actually, that film, even though it's a horror movie, and it's not really, I don't think they were trying to create an icon out of Paula Shepherd's character per se. You know, even though that disturbing knife bag mask imagery was like all over the cover of the VHS I remember when I was growing up, which was kind of iconic in itself in a small way, but yeah, I was thinking about her character and how it's like, yeah, this movie kind of, it works on a couple different levels, and on one level it kind of is this story about a kid who is a bit disturbed and super smart,
Right.
but we're not sure really where her behavior is stemming from. So we're always kind of questioning what she's going to do and how she's going to do it. So I think just as an example of the use of a kid to create an origin story in a way.
Oh yeah. I mean, when you have movies like the original Omen, you know, where you
Oh,
get,
yeah.
you know, that was really cool because you get to see how the kid became, you know, whatever. Well, he was born into it. You know, mother was a jackal. That's what you're gonna get. I loved Brightburn because of the whole
Ah,
element of
yes, yeah.
you're seeing the Superman origin story told on the Bizarro World, where it's like, oh, this is not the Superman you're looking for, you know what I mean? And it was great. I love when they're creative with it. Even with The Ring, and I'm talking here the 2004 American-Japanese co-production starring Naomi Watts,
Oh, yeah, good call.
which I really love because we get to know her origin story, but we don't, because we know what she experienced, but she was like this before that, and we don't know what that is, how she became the beast, how Samara became to be the way she is. And I love that element because it was like a pseudo origin story, and I thought it was great the way that happened.
That's a good call, Bill. That they do delve into Samara in that film, and I'm
She
with
never
you.
sleeps.
Why does she never sleep?
Yeah. Why do you hurt people? I don't know, but I do. You know, and it's like, oh my God, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like that stuff is chilling, just
Yeah.
those isolated moments and those sentiments. And that film really did do the creepy kid thing properly, I think, because
Yeah.
it's become such a cliche these days, in most movies. It's just so
Yeah. Well, that's why, I mean, like, you know, you think of the first time, you know, when the human race walked out of Africa, walked out of, you know, the Great Rift down in southern Africa, and we went into the European area, and Neanderthals met, you know, Homo erectus, you know, what were we at that time? Were we erectus? I don't know. But anyway, we were close enough. And we look different from them. They look different from us. I mean, our human race began, you know, in Africa. They're black people going to this European environment with these white-skinned, weird-looking Neanderthal people. And they were, can you imagine when he looked at each other for the first time? Who the fuck is that? You know, it'd be like an alien just landed, you know, and they have to like come to terms with each other, and maybe, or they're gonna go to war because automatically they face the uncanny for real. And it's like, does this person become assimilated, or must they be destroyed, just like horror film? So when you take these, when you take the mystery element out of any horror film, you're destroying, you're weakening those elements of the uncanny and the element of the other. Because once we get to know the other, then the other is no longer scary.
Yeah, and I largely agree with that sentiment, Bill. And I'm maybe going to contradict it a little bit here,
Good, I'm ready to fight you, man.
because I was complaining about the the Texas Chainsaw Massacre
Right.
prequels and Hannibal Rising, and
Oh boy.
a film that I think actually was helped by adding an origin story. And I'm not sure if you've even seen it yet, is Rob Zombie's Halloween.
No, I need to. I always forget. Forgive
Because
me.
I know the two of us are on the same page with Carpenter's film We Don't Like It.
Right.
Sorry.
Overrated.
Not sorry.
Not scary.
Yeah, it's like and I was actually looking forward to the Rob Zombie film, and I wasn't disappointed by it. I think it's better than Carpenter's film.
Wow, that's cool.
And I like what Zombie does is because when I'm watching the Carpenter film, I didn't feel an investment in the characters. I didn't care about Michael Myers or why he was killing these people. Mm-hmm. That was actually a movie where just him being a random killing machine was actually boring, like you said, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
It did nothing for me. And when I watched Rob Zombie's version, I was like, it was like watching a director who was like clearly a fan of the film and wanted to sort of do it with his own personal stamp on it. And that's apparent through the whole thing. I think it does have his sensibility. Mm-hmm. Granted, it's like he's transposing kind of some of his redneck tendencies into suburbia, but he makes it work, I think. And part of what I like about that film is you do get to spend time with little Michael Myers and kind of learn. Granted, it's kind of some pop psychology, but yeah. I like the effort that goes into it. To me, that's Zombie kind of showing an interest where Carpenter didn't seem to have as much interest in that character or the other characters for that matter. So I kind of felt more invested in that film because there was that backstory and there was that time and interest taken with that. And I think there's some, it is flawed because it was made for Dimension and there are some obvious places where stuff, if you watch the deleted scenes for that film, it's obvious Zombie wanted to do stuff differently where and Dimension said, no, we want you to make this more like the original film. So if you watch the bonus features, you'll see somewhat different of a vision there.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I appreciated what he did with that film. And I thought it was, for me, it was welcome what he did. And it was well executed, I thought. So.
No, that's cool. And, you know, I think what we're talking about is simply what it comes down to is good storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, period. You know, if you could get us invested in the characters, and I've seen movies where within 5 minutes, I'm in, mm-hmm. I love the characters. And other movies, it's like, oh, they got killed, whatever. You know what I mean? And it's not like, you know, in the ones that I'm invested in, it's like, I don't want this person to go, you know? And mm-hmm. that's, and to do that in such a short amount of time, it's vital. You have to, you know, you could still maintain mystery. You could feed us whatever you want, but not give us all of it. And, you know, if we care about the characters, then, and with the element of mystery, then you have a great horror movie because we're in it.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, even Get Out, you know, going back to that, you know, I love the characters. And the main character, I mean, that was the first film in many, many moons where I was screaming at the screen at the theater. And I remember yelling to, you know, Daniel Kaluuya's character, Chris Washington. I was like, kill him! And I was, you know, that was fucking Caleb Landry Jones. And I'm like, what am I doing? I'm watching a movie. And it's like, that's how they got me in.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, this is not horror by any means, although, you know, it's wartime film. The movie, you know, Das Boot, you know, the German film from like 82. Mm-hmm. You're following these German sailors who are like, we're just sailors. We're in a war. We're fighting for our country, not for this Hitler guy, which, you know, most of them are mocking. And they're like, we just want to get home. And when they get home, they're under attack. And I'm like, no, no, don't. And I'm like, wait, I'm rooting for the wrong guys. The British are shooting at them. It's like, well, you know, they're our allies. You know, take those guys out. And it was great because it totally thrust in your face the whole element of humanity. And it's like, man, you know, getting to know each other. Again, taking away that mystique of the other. So they could be, you know, not destroyed, but assimilated, or at least we could shake hands and go, you know, welcome brothers and sisters. Let's try and be nice. You know, let's try and get along. Let's try and talk. Let's learn from each other and grow. So I love that stuff. But I think we brought up a whole bunch of great different examples of when it works and when it doesn't. And that it comes down to how much is revealed.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what, Bill? I have one that I was kind of saving because...
Ooh, let's go.
Because you and other people I'm learning how many other people actually really love this movie, and I just, for whatever reason, hadn't gotten around to it. And that movie is Behind the Mask: The Rise of Leslie Vernon.
Yes.
And I think, I was thinking about this show topic for a while, and just watching that the other night, I was like, okay, yeah, we really got to do this because I want to talk about this movie because it's all about the origin of a persona, basically,
Yeah.
and this made-up character, just brilliant. Nathan Basil plays the
He's
titular Leslie Vernon, yeah.
one of my favorite actors, man. He's just incredible.
Yeah, and I gotta say, Bill, I for as great as he is, I love Angela Gethals. I believe that's how you say her name.
Gethel, probably.
Gethals, yeah.
Gerthel, it's probably Gerthel.
I looked up the pronunciation and I totally forgot what it was, so I apologize if I butchered it.
That's right. Nobody's listening to the show anymore, anyway.
Bill, basically, The Last Knock has become the last horror podcast, I think, that in existence. So, but I know you think highly of this movie, and I was like, okay, I'll finally watch this thing. And I totally love the approach of it. I love how you get to know these characters. I love how it starts off as. It reminded me a lot of the Blair Witch Project, actually, in its aesthetic, kind of in the early going, because it's like a found footage sort of thing, where they're making this documentary about this guy who is aspiring to be like a Freddy or a Jason, or a Michael, and they're following him kind of through his routine, what he plans to do to sort of create his legacy, which is going to be to slaughter a bunch of nubile teenagers on a certain night. And he just breaks down the process. It's this deconstruction of the genre that, granted, 10 years before Scream had done it, but I think Leslie Vernon does it better, actually, in a lot of ways. And I love this moment in the third act where it stops being a found footage movie and it becomes the movie. It becomes the Leslie Vernon movie. And you see this change. It goes from the handheld camera to this smooth transition into actual camera cinematography, an actual professional production, which I thought was so ingenious. I just loved that, and how Leslie Vernon basically lays out his plot to these filmmakers. It's like, I'm going to do this, and this is how I'm going to do it on this night. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, wait a minute, this is going to be a boring ass movie if everything goes exactly the way he says it's going to go. And needless to say, it doesn't. But it does, but it doesn't. And I love how they do it. And it's just the whole thing is an origin story leading up to kind of we know nothing about this guy, and they build up this mystique around him. They build up this kind of mythos. And I loved it, and I love how, and then it turns into his movie in the end. He kind of takes
The
charge
reins,
of,
yeah.
charge of this persona he's created, and he runs with it. And there are some, delightful wrinkles in the plot that occur late in the game that I really liked, which elevate the film even more.
Agreed.
Yeah, I thought kind of like, man, this is like, to me, this is like, it beats a prequel to some well-established character.
Oh,
This
hell
is
yeah.
like, this is creative. It's pulling from, it's self-aware and it's pulling from slasher stuff the way Scream did, and the way the Cabin in the Woods pulled from stuff. But again, so well executed, so well done, and It is a memorable movie. It's a movie I'm gonna keep in my collection, you
Oh
know.
yeah, definitely.
Now,
I have to get it on Blu-ray.
yeah, Scream Factory, I did a
Yeah.
version of it recently,
And
so
they do excellent versions of everything. Scream and Shout Factory, fantastic.
yeah, that's actually how I got it. I picked it up as a blind buy off their Shocktober sale recently, so
That's awesome. Yeah, Scott Glosserman, he wrote and directed Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. He did a phenomenal job. And the cinematographer for it that helped, adjust the look and all was Jaron Prezant. And he's the one, he was the second unit director of cinematography or director of photography on Looper. And
Oh, okay. Wow,
so
that's cool.
he's having his own rise in the industry. So that's really cool. But oh yeah, that is such a great, great movie, man. You will not be disappointed.
Yeah, and something I liked is how Robert Englund is in it
Yup.
as kind of the Donald Pleasance character.
Yup.
But the thing I like about him is I think filmmakers often enlist him because they know he can go over the top really spectacularly. He toes a real line in
Yes, he
Behind the
does.
Mask. He's a lot more subtle than he usually is, but he's also still really funny in those subtle ways. Like he'll like give a look to the camera, and it's
Oh,
just the
yeah.
most hilarious thing you've ever seen, because of the way he does it. But
Exactly.
it's also a really subdued performance at the same time from him, which I thought was really, really neat. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why I liked him so much in Wishmaster. It's like, he played this, eccentric, wealthy guy. And I could, now that I think about it, he had sort of like a minor Vincent Price flair to him.
Oh,
And
okay, yeah.
that's what I like, because Vincent Price, could do the drama, could do the comedy, could do the over the top, can reel it in. And when he reels it in, you're almost shocked by it. It's like, but no, that's awesome, man. That's a good place to end it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I wanted that to be the big one because I was like, this is
That is the
perfect.
big
It's
one.
not some cash grab prequel to something. It's its own thing, and it. Even though there's been talk of a sequel, I don't know if there's any movement on that right now.
Yeah, like Killer Clowns from Outer Space is going to be have a sequel. Been hearing that for 15 years.
I think I checked on the IMDb, and I think it's been in development or some state of pre-production since like 2017, so I'm not sure if it's going to happen, but.
Development hell, Johnny. That's where that is.
Yeah, but I mean, I'd probably be happy if they just, again, it's like the devil's already been demystified. We don't necessarily need a sequel. This
No.
obviously has its following, and obviously people love it for what it is, and it's ingenious. So I'm fine. I'm fine that we just have this one. So.
Yeah, definitely. It was so much fun.
Yep.
And brilliant. And my taking a swig of coffee means that I'm going to
It's
read
scream
some
out time.
scream outs and hopefully not fuck them up. These are people that I'm going to give you their name and their tag on Twitter, and that's where you can follow them. They're all awesome souls. And the first one is we're filming this 2 days before Halloween. Filming, holy shit. Like, I need another coffee. We're recording this 2 days before Halloween, and the great Chantel Laura Handley, otherwise known as Chantel Handley, Ley. She's a wonderful artist. She's a traditional pastel artist, and she draws the faces of film, horror with heart, and that's her art. And she's fantastic. And you can go right to her website, to ChantelLauraHandley.com, and check out all the stuff that she's doing. She's big on women in horror. She has a shop on Bitly. Go to Horror Shop, and she's out of Australia. And just her work is fantastic. I love it. She just did a Pumpkinhead piece, Tony Todd piece. She was doing one each day for Halloween, the month of October, and it was just fantastic.
Yeah, I look at her stuff, Bill, and I'm just so taken aback by her talent.
I
Yeah,
know.
it's cool stuff.
I know. At one point, I have to get one of her pieces, man. I have to.
Oh yeah.
Kelly Maroney, with an I. actor in Fast Times, Night of the Comet, Chopping Mall. We all know these two awesome films. Ryan's Hope, The Deep Ones, new films and more. She's an actor, a voiceover actress, and a wife too. Danielle Ulin, Danielle Ulin, and she's also an animal lover. She's out of LA. Check her out on imdb.com and also go to kellymaroney.com for more. John Grant, who's that? That is Y2John84. Hello, my horror friends. JG here, your Synop host. Horror Trek, rated horror reviews, the horror blog, Letterboxd. He's out of England, and you could check him out at wixsite.com at Y2John841. How about that? Charlie Bond. Who's Charlie Bond? That is Miss, M-I-S-S, Charlie Bond. British actor, voiceover artist. She's also on IMDb. She's a producer of Cheerleaders V for Five. Cheerleaders V. Puzzle designer. She's also connected with Deadlock Rooms, and she's a Renaissance woman. She's out of London. And you can find out more about Charlie Bond at charliebond.com. And since we're talking about Cheerleaders V, Power Tool Cheerleaders versus Boy Band Screeching Dead. What the hell is that? That's a movie I invested in because it looks amazingly hilarious. Power Tool Cheerleaders, again, versus the Boy Band of the Screeching Dead is a full tilt horror comedy, musical feature film, bloody bring it on, and I can't wait for it. It looks like it's going to be just insane. Larson. Who's Larson? He is My Choice is 666. It's better to be feared than loved, and fuck you, Jeff Bezos. Out of Brooklyn, New York. Love nice. Him. Check him out. Amy the Final Girl. Who's that? Amy, that is me. How about that? Hi, my name is Amy, and I'm a horror movie addict. I'm a mom, wife, and lover of God and Green Day. Wow. Aspiring horror writer. She's part of the writing community and horror fam. All that good stuff. Peter DeVilbiss. Who's that? Vilbiss, Peter on Twitter. Manic Minus Depression. That's cool, huh? That sounds like a great name for a band.
Oh, yeah. I'm surprised that isn't.
He's into combat, sports, music, comedy, comics, literature, art, horror, sci-fi, and donkeys. He retweets a lot. And where is he? Parts unknown. And, oh, wow. Did I have a duplicate? Yeah, I did. I had a duplicate. So I'm going to erase that right now. Boop. And I'm going to go to, in fact, I'm popping online real quick because I wanted to mention this person anyway, very cool soul on Twitter. And, oh, I hope he pops up real quick because, oh, I'm in the wrong spot, man. You know, when you have two Twitter accounts, life can get pretty, pretty weird.
I can imagine it's like having multiple personalities.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have them. No, I don't. No, I don't. I really don't. No, I don't. Anyway, Tommy Doyle. Tommy Doyle, 47. As he says, I was a good kid. I got babysat by Laurie Strode till one night Michael Myers came and changed me forever. I won't stop till I stop Michael. He's out of Haddonfield, Illinois. He has a great, great Twitter handle. Check out his page every day. It's a blast. Great guy, absolutely great guy, and he's very kind to the show as well as to our Crash Palace website. So that's really cool.
I do love, Bill, how he's immortalized Paul Rudd in his avatar.
Yes, so it's completely.
It's Paul Rudd's Tommy Doyle from Halloween 6, not young Tom, not little Tommy Doyle from the 78 film.
Yep, exactly. And this is a wonderful friend of the show. She's really sweet. She just moved cross country.
Oh, yeah.
She's getting her whole life rearranged. And she was absolutely kind enough. I am beyond honored. She said, Bill, is it okay if I write for Crash Palace? And I'm like, you have to ask? I'm glad I don't have to beg. She's absolutely wonderful soul. I love her writing. You will too. Her works will be on Crash Palace soon. CrashPalaceProductions.com. And that is Susan on the Ledge. And her current bylines are on Diabolique Mag, Crash Palace, even though she doesn't have one yet, but it's coming. Mm-hmm. And Grumpire Online. And you could check out her work in Lee Gambin's A Very Special Episode book, available for pre-orders at Amazon. And she is at the Lake House. Just honored that she came to me. Johnny, you write so much for Crash Palace. I write when I can, and I wish I could write like you guys, because you're both really phenomenal. So I'm just honored. She's, you know, you two guys make Crash Palace that much better. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, Bill, when she told me she was going to outreach to you, I was just like, I felt like this weird weight in my chest, not to sound cheesy about it, but I was just like, I'm flattered that you would decide to come over here. You know, it was just very humbling, because it's like, that's the feeling you get when you respect someone for years and years. I think I've had such respect for Susan, and it continues, you know, to this day. I mean, I'll mention this, though by the time this show posts, this will have already happened. Susan is leaving a 1428 Elm. And I was like, I'm going to go with you. Cause I started writing for this site because of the huge amount of respect I had for you. And I was actually pushing myself probably more than I would typically, for a person, you know, cause it's like, you are who you are and I like you a lot.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't know that I want to, I just don't want to acclimate to some new person running the show. Cause you know, and I think it's time for me to sort of take it a little easier on myself, and I would just like to focus on Crash Palace stuff. So
yay.
Yeah. So basically after Halloween, I will no longer be at 1428 Elm either, but as far as I know, the plan is to continue with that site. So, I mean, there'll be good people there. So, I mean, I think if you want an alternative to your big three horror sites out there, which tend to get the retweet action and attention, you know, always give a gander to the little guy too, because there's stuff there that'll be just as worth your time. So, if not more so. So, yeah.
Well, you got, you know, knowing how she writes and knowing what she's will be delivering shortly, I'm just thrilled, and knowing what you have coming down, and I'm just a very happy camper, because sometimes I know we're all busy, you know, life is just insane, and next stop Willoughby, and thank you for laughing at that. I hope people got it.
Yeah, Bill, you know, I have a ton of ideas. It's just a matter of getting them typed up, so I'm like, ugh.
I agree, man. I agree. I have two ideas for articles that I want to do. I'm going to say it again. I'm going to rate all of John Carpenter's movies. There's only one I haven't seen, and I have no interest in it. I'm not going to see it. It's not a horror.
is it Memoirs of an Invisible Man, Bill?
No, is it that one? I don't know. I saw this one. I'm like, he did that? I'm like, I can't. I just can't. So,
well, you know, he did that biopic on Elvis back in the 70s too. But you're just looking at horror stuff, right?
No, because Big Trouble in Little China is like phenomenal, man. I can't ignore that one.
I want to see that ranking, so.
Yeah, you will. And and I can't wait for the negative feedback I get from the world.
I have something that'll probably get some negative feedback. So, but it'll probably get a lot of clicks at the same time.
I hope so, man.
We'll talk about it. Yeah.
Awesome. So that's it. So where can people find you, Johnny?
Basically, moving forward, you can find my writing and at Crash Palace Productions, and you can also find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Num. There are no H's in those Johnnies, but there are B's in those Nums. And if you're really clever, you can find me on Facebook, but I'm not going to tell you my real name.
Ooh, I like that. Cool. And
I just mostly post cat rescue pictures and satirical articles, even though the lines between satire and reality are becoming increasingly blurred. So,
is there a line anymore?
I don't know how the Onion and the Hard Times continue to come up with ideas. That's all I got to say. What about you, Bill?
You could find me on Twitter at Crash Palace if you like erotic crime thrillers, and I know that you do because it's not a traditional publishing category. You can follow me at Noir Kink for my Kink Noir series, and CrashPalaceProductions.com for links to this show, as well as articles from the wonderful Johnny Numb and the lovely and vivacious Susan on the Ledge.
Yay,
and that's it, man.
Awesome, Bill. I feel like we've developed from a humble origin to a fully fleshed out podcast.
I like that. We're ending right there, man. Don't go any further. That's it. Good night, folks.
Good night.